deterministic or utilitarian doctrine of law. So, but no one can possibly help taking cover when someone points a gun at him. That's what it would mean. Not in any man's power. That's what Hobbes asserts. Hence, it is not absurd, nor reprehensible, nor against right reason, if man takes every trouble to defend his body and limbs, his own body and limbs, from death and pains, and preserves body, his own body and limbs. But what is not against right reason, this all say is done justly and rightly. For by the name of right is meant nothing but the liberty which each has to use his natural faculties according to right reason. Hence the first foundation of natural right is that everyone protects his life and limbs as much as he can. This is a rock bottom fact. Everything else is infinitely unimportant. This is the base of Hobbes' doctrine. Now you can call it, you can use the word self-preservation, which Hobbes uses, which Locke uses more frequently, but which is, they mean, and Locke and Rousseau, of course, too. Now, then comes an argument which is also of wonderful lucidity in itself, as the right to the end, self-preservation, would be void and nugatory without the right of the means. So this stone here, if we have cave dwellers, which the other fellow is trying to get to throw at me, I have of course the right to that stone too. And anything. Now, good, everything necessary for self-preservation. But now it comes a different thing. I may believe that, say, a certain daisy is a means of self-preservation, very foolishly. Do I have a right to that daisy? Hobbes says, yeah, but let's see, foolishly. Who decides as to which means for your self-preservation are good and which are bad? Either you or somebody else, say a wise man, to whom you go and ask him for his advice. But you don't know him. This man doesn't give a damn for your self-preservation. Therefore, if you want a clear mathematical rule, everyone is a judge. Everyone is a judge. So there is no higher right of the man of prudence. The fool is under no obligation to ask the prudent man for his advice because he can't trust him. Hence, it follows, since, however, anything can be regarded by a fool as a possible mean of self-preservation, no line can be drawn. Everyone has by nature a right to everything. A right to everything. Hobbes makes it very clear at the beginning of paragraph 12 that the natural desire for everything is something fundamentally different from the natural right to everything. Men naturally have an infinite desire, we have seen that. But in addition, they have a natural right to everything. I.e., if a man is absolutely sensible and has no ambitions and no desire for comfort or what have you, and only wants to have that to which he has absolute right, preserve life and limb. Even then, from this basis alone, there follows a right to everything. Now, and that's obvious, if everyone has a right to everything, there is a constant war of everybody against everybody, because everywhere is conflict. Hobbes, in his delicacy, doesn't speak of conflict about women, but this would surely ought to be part of it, because no one knows who belongs to whom. And this is, Hobbes is really not very interested in that. Hobbes thinks very massively of this terrible enemy of nature, death, as someone says, and to protect life and to prolong it. That is the primary and most respectable thing in the world, and in what he adds, the only solid faith. There is, speaking in practical terms, there is of course one argument in favor of that. when you look around about how societies keep themselves in shape, then you won't find all these systems of rewards and punishment. Now, what is the extreme punishment? I mean, disregarding our subtle distinction between ordinary capital punishment or capital punishment with torments. But capital punishment is regarded as the greatest punishment. Why? Because people fear most, and the most hardened criminals, as I have learned from my source, the TV, they fear nothing as much as what they call the hot seat. And which seems to be what Hobbes has in mind. Therefore, this is something on which you can count. It is, whether it is noble or base, that's unimportant, but you can, that is solid. Here you are not fooled by any good natured assumption. That is what Hobbes now. How does the thing, and therefore in paragraph 13, now let me first say a few more things. In paragraph 13, in the second of the everyone desires by natural necessity what is good for him. And there is no one who regards this war of every all against all, which belongs to that status, state of nature, by nature, as good for him. This is another refutation of so-called ethical relativism. There is no relativity here. The end of relativity, one can say, is death. The fear of death. There, the nonsense stops. And that they this man has this taste, and that is that. In that respect, all men have the same taste at the end of relativity. And therefore, you see how superficial it is to base Hobbes' doctrine. To explain the doctrine of good and bad on the basis of the preliminary statements of chapter 6. So here this complicated order of good and bad things, which leads to the strange consequence that there is a summum malus, a highest evil, as he says elsewhere, and no highest good. That is, gives Hobbes a moral orientation. Therefore, he's not ethical relativist. His ethical teaching is very poor and perverse, you can say, but it is surely not a relativistic. Not someone. Yes. Oh, no, you were first.
When you were talking about chapter 9, the fact that we don't know what really contributes to our self preservation, and so every man has, what every man says has to be admitted and equal before the tribunal. Isn't this another means of saying that men's reason is their first objective? Can't find any objective criterion.
Yeah.
The final objective criterion is death versus life. But man says, this daisy is going to contribute to my self-preservation.
Surely not. But that Hobbes doesn't deny. But in spite of, but this, that this man is to be respected, so to speak, in his foolish choice, derives from something which is absolutely not foolish, but inevitable.
But you can't really say whether it's a foolish choice or not.
Of course you can, all that you can say. I mean, compare a daisy with a wonderfully prepared stone, which is the best missile. Even all social scientists today would say the stone. Because it's only a question of a means toward an end, and this can be determined. That's no. You first, Mr. Clark.
Yeah. If the fear of death is such an overriding fear, and the attempt to avoid it is an impulsion of nature, then I do not understand how Hobbes can have felt alleviated, or can have alleviated this fear, even when the sovereign power is erected. Because it seems to me that since everybody is a judge of his own self-preservation, if, let's say, a policeman comes walking in the door to take somebody to the station, he sees him with the weapon, and he has no knowledge of what the sovereign who is stationed there designs.
That is a difficulty for Hobbes, but he would say, from a long experience, unless it is an absolutely fantastic condition, as it existed in Germany for some time in the Russia, the policemen do not go around and shoot people in front of them. this, the policemen are there to prevent some foolish fellow from giving up. But this question is fundamentally the same, that Hobbes' point is this: the fear of violent death must persist in civil society, because otherwise the fear of capital punishment would cease to be effective. Yeah? It must, that is necessary. But on the other hand, in civil society, people are protected. Of course, no one can protect you against if you put cross midway at the wrong time of the day and you suffer some deprivation. That no one can protect you there. See.
Nobody would protect you. You would endanger your own life. Why should he?
I mean, you don't know what I mean. This even in a first-rate police, murders still happen. Yeah. Murders still happen. There is no absolute exclusion of that. But the security is relatively great because the threat of punishment gives a certainty. The difficulty which Hobbes must face is, of course, if the government as government becomes a public menace. And Hobbes cannot provide for that. That's number one. And number two, war. The solution which was attempted later, not by Hobbes, but on a Hobbesian basis, is in the first place to abolish capital punishment. Because everyone entered society, even the criminal, in order to get his life protected. Therefore, this was always a tacit reservation. Beccaria, the Count Beccaria, an Italian writer in the late 18th century, in his book on punishments and crimes, made this point on this basis. And the other is, of course, war. But if you abolish war, you don't need armies anymore. So there is a world, of course, Hobbes never dreamt of that. But the later pacifism, a certain kind of pacifism, is, of course, inspired by the Hobbesian motive. A world without any danger of violent death. A world of perfect security, as we call it. And it is no accident, I believe, that a younger contemporary of Hobbes, Leibniz, as far as I know, is the inventor of life insurance, which is, of course, as you know, not an insurance of your living forever after, but an insurance against the bad economic consequences of your criminal life, which is part of the story. This is the point, security, maximum of security. And this, security is surely a need for man, but in Hobbes it becomes the overriding.
But it seems to me, if I come back to what you said, that there's not only a possibility that the government turns into a public menace, but a probability. Because the sovereign still retains the liberties of taking from everybody what he pleases.
Yeah, but still, but on the other hand, I must also say this. The sovereign had to be in such a wonderful position. Yeah? I mean, if the subjects are tolerably fearful, instead of nature, he's obeyed unquestioningly. He's also in many, his vanity is perfectly satisfied.
This is another reason, too, I think, why Hobbes recommends only one man as the sovereign.
Yeah, sure. Because this man, every man must be forced by the law to bow to him. His vanity or pride is totally satisfied by his very position. There is, therefore, an incentive for him not to do things by which he becomes despised. There is, for Hobbes, there is no solution to that. If the sovereign is wicked, then nothing can be done about it. But Hobbes says much of the wickedness of sovereigns comes from the resistance of the subject. This source of wickedness of sovereign, he will dispose of as he says. Yes?
Doesn't the sovereign also have to consider the principle on which all the other men operate, that is, the fear of violent death, and the vanity?
I beg your pardon?
The fact that the sovereign also is subject to the fear that all other men have of violent death also would tend to make the sovereign good or
prevent him from becoming a...
Yeah, but he is relatively, I mean, according to this legal schema, he is perfectly secure because he's at the head of all armed forces.
Well...
And the others don't have... can be completely disarmed.
I was thinking of the example of Mao Zedong to Charles I.
Yeah, but this Gustavs knew quite well. He has written a long book. The trouble was that Charles was not admitted to be the full sovereign. He was supposed to, the sovereign at that time was called the king in parliament. That meant a dual head. And that was the ruin. Because in the moment of a disagreement between king and parliament, who had the right of way? And since this could not be decided by law, it could only be decided by war. That shows only how necessary it is to have one clearly defined sovereign. Preferably, but not necessarily, a king. Yes.
Perhaps I misunderstood you before. You said that Hobbes and say there were three principal causes to hurt, or as the English here it says quarrel. And then you said they could be reduced to two. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any reason why he didn't want to reduce them to two that you can figure out that he used diffidence?
Yeah, but if you analyze it, I mean, it would really take as much of, let me see, where is it on page...
It's the beginning of chapter 13.
Yeah, I know, page 81, yeah? What is, yeah, but if you look at that, what is, from equality, precedes difference. But how does it precede from difference? Because different men might desire the same thing, yeah?
That's competition, I think.
Yes, yes. Now look. Competition. That is what he calls. No, later on he had a different order. Competition as a form of competition, diffidence, law. But if you look here in the way to their end, which is principally their own conservation, and sometimes their delectation only. Now, conservation is of course self-preservation. Now, the question is, what is their delectation? It, that could mean, in the first place, they want something which they do not need for conservation, for self-conservation. Say, one particular female, and they don't need it for self-preservation. It's only for delectation. Yeah? Good. Or maybe jewels, or whatever any else might be. But the question is, this is here open. Good. Now, in the next case, he discusses two things. When he says, in the next item, yeah? Next paragraph. Conservation and others won't take pleasure in contemplating their own power in the act of conquest. That's pride or vanity. Again, and then the third is obviously only vanity. Now, the question is, what about that desire, the desire for unnecessary things, which has nothing to do with vanity? That's the problem. Now, I believe the problem can only be solved in this way. You have the root phenomena are either irrational pride or rational fear, self-preservation. Yes, but but on the other hand, self-preservation needs means, that, you know, stones, guns, sticks. But even there is something else. There is no earthly reason why you should not have a drink, say, cream or milk instead of water, which you can have it. In brief, self-preservation naturally expands, if possible, into comfortable self-preservation. Yeah? That's law calling. Why should you preserve yourself uncomfortably if you can preserve yourself comfortably? Do you see that? I mean, think of a very hard and half-ruined bed compared with a very convenient bed or any other example from any theory. Good. And now, but what Hobbes implies, of course, in this, if it's a strict doctrine, if you insist on comfortable self-preservation, you have a much weaker cause than if you insist on straight, simple self-preservation. Because you obviously expose yourself to attack much more, the more claims you make. Is it not clear? This, in other words, there is a kind of desire for non-necessary which is not identical with self-preservation, but which is a possible and legitimate and conditionally legitimate expression of self-preservation. That is, I think, therefore, the formula of law. Competent self-preservation is so good because it allows for distress and yet reminds us of the fact that this, in both cases they are bodily comforts. Bodily comforts. I mean, the minimum of the decisive comfort, near life, and then the other comforts which are not equally necessary, they belong together. And the other thing which is so bad is fancy and pride, because these are wholly unsubstantial. Solid comfort, that's a very English, a very good English expression in activity. This is to be allowed. And so the schema is this. The most important, absolutely fundamental and overriding consideration is guaranteeing life and death. But then, if it is feasible, as much of comfort, solid comfort, as possible. And therefore, science stands for this purpose. That will gradually appear when we come to the chapter on the duty of sovereign. It's the duty of the sovereign to take care that people not merely are preserved in their mere life, but also that they have the maximum of comfort compatible with common good. Yes, you want to say something?
How do you square with the passage that we show that some people are glad to be used within modest bounds?
These are people who have already learned the lesson.
In particular, why is this word so confusing by confusing to mention?
I do not know. It is also not perfectly clear in the children. I mean, the reason which the answer which I will give you does not satisfy me at all. But there is a very impressive chapter in Thucydides, in the first book, in the speech of the Corinthians in Sparta. No, of the speech of the Athenians in Sparta. And Hobbes knew, of course, Thucydides quite well. And which he says, the Athenians say there are three motives for empire and strength. And they are exactly these. Gain, fear, and honor. Now, this tripartition has perhaps something to recommend it. Apart from the being points. But, so in other words, this is only a very poor explanation, obviously. It only says there was someone before Hobbes, and not a negligible and inconsiderate man, who made this tripartition, and Hobbes definitely knew it. But the context in Thucydides is, of course, an entirely different one from the Hobbes. Therefore, it's not sufficient. But I would say, from Hobbes, one can see how you could arrive at something if you start from the bifurcation. Life and limb, self-preservation. Management. But then there is something else which is not identical with either, namely comfort. More than absolutely necessary for the sake of self-preservation. That is called gain. Good leader. The order is, this is, even in the theater, by no means fully clear, and I can't help it. I can only notice it's not fully clear. But one corpse will probably answer that, well, what alternative did I omit? What did you omit? Competition for unshareable things, diffidence and glory. But there are, of course, other reasons that people fight, but he would say they have to do with opinions, and these are the religious wars and this kind of thing that belongs to an entirely different group, which is different. These are the things which man by nature, you know, without the intermixture of theory, without the intersection of theory, is fighting. Well, there are many, many more things which we would have to discuss. We didn't discuss at all this chapter on contracts. This follows, it's only to remind you of the order. We have the right of everybody against everybody. An unbearable condition, because in such a condition, everyone's life is always insecure. Therefore, the only way out is peace. Therefore, the fundamental law of nature, as distinguished from the right of nature, is see peace. this follows. Now, this is a law of nature, i.e. something which restricts us. Whereas the right of nature entitled, and therefore Hobbes says at the beginning of chapter 14, right and law are opposites. A right giving us a title to, and a law limits us. And the right comes first. Right comes first. There is a fundamental inalienable right, which cannot inalienable right. It is truly inalienable. That is the point. He makes it quite clear in chapter 14 when he discusses which rights. Here, page 86, bottom. Not all rights are alienable. A man cannot lay down the right of resisting them that assault him by force, take away his life. And so the same may be said of wounds and chains and imprisonment. Yeah. And you do, and lastly, the motive and end for which this announcement is introduced is nothing else but the security of a man's person in his life, and in the means of so preserving life as not to be weary of it. This enlarges, that's comfortable. Because some people get weary of life if they do not have confidence. So, this is the position. Now, but how can they get people who were wholly dissociated, how can they have peace? Peace is the simplest case of a common good. I do not know how the present day positivists get around with that peace is a good which cannot be enjoyed by anyone unless it is enjoyed by all. You know? I do not know how they say there is no common good, you know. I do not see how, perhaps they forget about that because it takes it's too much for granted. So there is a need for peace, but these are not people yet who can have a common good because they are not yet a community. They are only isolated. Therefore, they must unite. And union can only take place by contract, for the reason discussed before. Therefore, the first law of nature, specific, is keep contract. And, of course, the contract underlying all other contracts, because a contract which we make for renting a piece of land or whatever it may be, is, of course, possible only if they are in the first place the fundamental contracts by which the other contracts are guaranteed. And then there follow other things. For example, you must be nice. If you are nasty, you hurt people all the time, and there will be conveyance of the moral. The moral virtue. But they come after, for the reason I indicated before, and we will discuss next time in chapter 15. But the point which one cannot stress strongly enough, that is no criticism of you, you said it. The natural right comes before the natural law. The natural law is derivative from natural law. That has never happened before Hobbes. And that is the deepest change truly in the whole natural law tradition. Because it was always understood formally that the obligation comes first before the rights come. Now the order is radically changed. In Descartes' Passions of the Soul, to which I alluded before, in the chapter, in the paragraph dealing with generosity, with the key virtue, there is a remark to, Descartes uses the word the rights. Generosity is concerned, and the root of all virtues is a concern with one's rights, with one's dignity. Right? The word duty, as far as I know, never occurs in the passions. You see, they are very different men, Descartes and Hobbes, but yet so when people use the word individualism, which is applied with equal generosity to all stoic, probably also conservative, that means very different things. And here is one much more specific criterion, namely, does right precede duty or the other? Today, the official.